Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. George T. Stagg Bourbon, 140 proof. Poured over one ice cube, not two. Now, you can buy him a drink. This is The Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hey, I admit I may have overset it when I or overstated it when I said that Aaron Sanchez is ready to become an ace. I may have been reaching there. But, you know, I got to throw – I'm going to do a mea culpa here, and I think Barker's going to have to do it as well in Baseball Central. Because, look, you know that I was one of those guys that was pounding the table, literally pounding the table, for Aaron Sanchez to move into the bullpen. I mean, my argument wasn't that I didn't think he could necessarily start. I just thought that Aaron Sanchez had better serve the Toronto Blue Jays in the bullpen. And I'm still not entirely certain that even if Marcus Stroman was healthy, or that if Marcus Stroman was healthy, you wouldn't see Aaron Sanchez in the bullpen anyhow. But you know what? I'm ready. I'm going to give that sucker up. I'm going to give that sucker up. If I'm Alex Anthopoulos right now, I'm saying I got to keep Aaron Sanchez in the rotation. If I need help in the bullpen, I got to go out and get a reliever. I'm going to admit, Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen. Aaron Sanchez is a closer. I thought it was best for the team. I was one of those guys that was on board with it. I was one of the guys pounding the table for it after watching this kid start. Ah, you gotta ride this out. You really do. He's not the finished product, but, man, he makes some real good hitters look really bad. And now that we're starting to see a bit of a track record, or now that we're starting to see some statistics as a starter pile up, and it's early in his career, I know that, but we're starting to see some things. The percentage of ground balls he's capable of inducing really makes me think that this guy's in the right place. One guy who has always cautioned against being too hasty to move Aaron Sanchez into the bullpen is Buck Martinez. But right from the start, when this was a topic of discussion, Buck, like John Gibbons, was saying, you know, you got to keep this in mind. Do you want an inning of that, or do you want the possibility of seven innings of that every time through the rotation? Based on what I'm seeing from Aaron Sanchez right now, I think Aaron Sanchez has to be viewed as a starter. Buck Martinez is a Blue Jays play-by-play voice on Sportsnet. He joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. And Buck, I'm doing the mea culpa here. I'm doing the mea culpa. He has to be a starter, doesn't he? He just does.
Yeah, he does. Until he fails over a long course of starts, a full year, a year and a half, you got to let him see if he can start. And last night when he started that game, he had such a relaxed delivery, and the ball was exploding out of his hand. And you saw the way Pujols went after him, and you saw the way Ibar went after him, and Mike Trout. And, you know, these are some of the best hitters in the game. And it was easy. And he was very patient with his curveball. He didn't try to make it break. He threw it and let it break. And it was terrific. And he's only going to get better. What I see in Sanchez, I saw in Dave Steep. I see the same type of movement, the same type of electricity in his arm, and now he's learning how to control his body. And when he does that, he's going to figure out how to take 80% off that fastball like Steve did and use that great breaking ball at will. And there's a lot of upside to Aaron Sanchez.
You know, Buck, I can't remember the start where I sort of came to, where I had my come to Jesus moment or come to Aaron moment, if you want. But I talked to John Gibbons about this the other day, and I made the point that at some point I started just assuming or kind of feeling like Aaron felt as if he could get out of any jam. You know what I mean? Like you watch him on the mound, and two men on, I got this. Now, sometimes he didn't have it. Sometimes it was a wild pitch. But unlike Daniel Norris, and I'm not criticizing Daniel Norris here, but unlike Daniel Norris, I saw somebody who thought that they were a pitch away from getting out of a jam.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's what you can't see. The radar gun doesn't show that. The stat sheet doesn't show that. You have to look at a guy's face. And a lot of the old scouts say he's got a good face, which means he is in control. And Aaron Sanchez had a good face last year in Montreal when he wrapped up the spring training by striking out three Mets to close out the game. And he's got a good face. He understands that he's in control. He can determine it. Yeah, he gets frustrated when he walks guys. It bothers him. But now what he's seeing now is he can throw strikes to Albert Pujols and Mike Trout and get them out.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to throw a perfect pitch. He can throw it down the middle and let it move and get them out. Once you see that yourself, and nobody can teach you that. You have to see it yourself. Once you see that, then the next start, he's going, well, I did that to Trout and Pujols. You try to hit this, and he's going to throw it over the heart of the plate, and he's only going to get better.
Buck, the question with him has always been third and fourth time through the lineup. And Pujols, who, again, is a real good hitter, he started to make some contact the second time through. He hit into a double play the third time through, mind you. Trout started to make a little bit more contact the third time through. But what's the difference in Aaron Sanchez, the starter now, compared to maybe Aaron Sanchez in that first start when it comes to navigating your way through a lineup the third time through? Is there a pitch that he has more confidence in? I know yesterday I thought he mixed more pitches in later in the game. Kevin Barker was talking about this. I thought he mixed more pitches in later in the game than he was earlier in the game.
Now, I don't think he makes pitches to locations of the plate. I think he's trying to stay down with it. I think he's trying to let it move. And I don't think there's any reason for him to say, I need to make this inside. Mm-hmm. I think if he focuses on quadrants, down, up, in, out, that's fine enough. You know, split the plate into fours, and that's all you need to do with his stuff right now. What he's going to learn is as he progresses in the third and fourth at bat, he's going to learn to throw that fastball at 80% and then back to 95% and then back to 75%. He will be able to throw about five different pitches with that fastball, and that will be enough for him to succeed. When he goes first inning, maybe he throws 85% fastball, fifth inning, 90%, seventh inning, 85 again, back and forth, plus the complement of his changeup and his breaking ball. And I think he's going to have a guy that can pitch eight, nine innings every time out.
Buck, did you have a problem with John sending him out last night for the eighth? Because, you know, when he came out, I mean, I was sitting next to Shy, and Shy said, you kind of surprised? And my initial reaction was, no, I would have done the same thing. And then, of course, when the result, you know, the game unravels a little bit, you kind of look back and scratch your head and go, maybe I had it wrong there. But I went back and thought about it this morning. I think I would have done the same thing, Buck.
Yeah. No, you know what? He's been handling these guys. And you know, Trout, Ibar gets a single. He broke his bat. And you know, there's a couple of boops in the whole situation. And it's just a matter of you're trying to build a pitcher here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a game, late in the game, where he's got a tie game. You're trying to build a pitcher and say, you're my guy. Let's go get him. This is your game. And there aren't enough starters that have that mentality. So you're trying to create that in Aaron Sanchez. You want to do that with Hutch. You want to do that with Norris when he gets here. Build a starter who says, this is my game. I own this game. Let me go back out and take care of it. And if he loses, he loses. But he's going to win more than he loses down the road because you did that early on.
You know, Buck, I've got to think, Josh Donaldson, one of the cruel things about baseball is you have the type of game that Josh Donaldson has, and then you find yourself standing in front of the media and answering for a play that just didn't work out. Guys who've played the game, I think, would have looked at what Josh did on that kind of that squibber, that ball off the end of the bat, trying to tag out Calhoun, I think it was. No, who was going to third base? Was Ibar going to third base?
Uh-huh.
And I think guys who played the game are probably nodding and going, yeah, I can see why he did that. Am I right in that? Because my first reaction is, come on, you got to go to first base. But then you look at the play, he sees the runner breaking. It's third base, game is close. You think you got a shot. And it took a hell of a slide, by the way, by Ibar to get around him. Did you have a problem with that play?
No, not at all. And Pat and I both said the same thing. You know, first of all, the ball's hit off the end of the bat. It's got all kinds of spin on it. He doesn't know where it's going, first of all. And he's thinking, if I can get this guy at third, not only do I get him, but I keep double play going and everything else. So, yeah, it didn't work out. And you know what? Everybody can say in retrospect, oh, he should have gone to first. Well, of course you can say that in retrospect. He's got to make a decision on the fly. Calhoun, who had hit a home run earlier in the game, cues one off the end of the bat, and it's coming down at you, and you don't know which way it's going to kick on this turf. So he's thinking, okay, if I can get this ball and dive back in the baseline, I'd probably get eyeballed. But it took a heck of a slide. I have no problem with it. He's got to make the decision on the fly. But it's easy to sit up in the seats, sit in the press box, sit wherever and say, oh, he should have gone to first. Well, of course. Well, you know what? When you're down there on the dirt, you got to make those decisions on the fly. I'll take my chances with Josh Donaldson making the right decision 9 times out of 10.
What do you think it is about this ballpark that is tailor-made for Josh Donaldson offensively? It's a great hitter's park. We know that. But I remember when that deal was made, speaking to a guy with the Jays organization, who told me, Jeff, this guy could set records in this ballpark. And I thought, okay, that's fine. But, you know, he might be able to set records in this ballpark. Is it the dimensions? What is it about this ballpark that just seems to be – it's a perfect park for him.
Yes, it is the perfect park for him because the ball carries to all parts of the field. And he was playing at ODOTCO Coliseum in Oakland, where you have to pull it as a right-handed hitter to hit it out, especially at nighttime. It's cold, it's damp, the ball doesn't carry. Plus, there's all sorts of foul territory where those pop-ups are in play. And a lot of those pop-ups that land in the seats in other ballparks are caught. So your at-bat is over in Oakland. I knew the moment they signed him that Donaldson was going to be able to hit balls out at right field. Last year, he had 2 balls out in right field in Oakland. This year, I believe he's hit 3 already,
yeah,
if not right center. Mm-hmm. So he knows that he doesn't have to pull everything. And when you don't have to pull everything, you don't have to be as fine with your stroke. You can let the ball travel. You can identify a pass ball or breaking ball. You just become a better hitter. I think the other guy that's going to really benefit if we can ever get him in the lineup is Justin Smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Smoke had a 20 home run season in Seattle. He's had 15, 19, and 20 in Seattle. But because of the situation now, he hasn't seen the field in quite a while. He was off to a pretty good start swinging the bat. But, you know, I'd like to see him get regular bats in this ballpark, too, because I think he'd have the same impact.
You know, we always talk about when you're playing a series, a 3 or 4 game series, you always wonder if the pitcher, the next night's pitcher, is watching what a guy is doing. And I know guys don't chart anymore, but is watching what a guy is doing and trying to maybe come up with something that might work for him. Did Drew Hutchison see anything last night that he from Aaron Sanchez, Buck, that he should apply today against or tonight against the Angels?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, Drew doesn't have the same kind of movement that Aaron has, and then, you know, that's the big difference. But at the same time, you could see when you make quality pitches down in the zone as Aaron did, he had success. The balls that he elevated, and that's been a problem for Drew, is he's pushing a lot of the balls and he needs to get out in front with his hand and get the ball down in the zone. Drew's got good stuff. I think he's going to be fine. We're going to see a stretch like we saw in the second half with him. But it's all about making quality pitches early in the at-bat to create a swing mentality. This Angel team is very aggressive. They like to swing the bat, so you need to take advantage of that. Make a quality pitch early on. Make them swing. And then when you make your borderline pitches, they will be in chase mode. So I think Hutch, of course, he watched what was going on last night. And you know, he's sitting next to Burley, and they're talking about what he did, and they're talking about how can I do that. And all of these conversations lead into his preparation for this start tonight. But I think, you know, he's going to want to go out there and replicate what Sanchez did because they're competitive, and that's how you get teams on a winning streak.
Buck, was great to do this morning. I'll see you at the park later.
All right, Jeff, you have a great day.
Thank you. That's Buck Martinez, TV play-by-play voice of the Blue Jays and Sportsnet. And yeah, Barker and I are going to talk about this, but you won't be hearing me suggest Aaron Sanchez move to the bullpen, unless, as Buck said, you see a run of difficulty. And by a run of difficulty, we're talking over the next season to season and a half. And for those of you out there who are saying, I told you so, yes, you did. I'm not afraid to admit when I have been told you so, and I was told you so. Having said that, no, I'm not going to bother going there. We are going to take your calls, by the way, pardon me, in Baseball Central when Barker joins me at 11 o'clock, because we didn't do Blue Jays calls in the first hour. So we'll be taking your calls and get you set for tonight's game. A lot to talk about. Interesting start for Drew Hutchison against the Angels. A tough start because Jared Weaver is a guy who does really well against the Blue Jays, and he likes this ballpark. He's not the same. Mike Wilner was making the point in the Blue Jays talk yesterday. He is not the same guy he was earlier in his career. He doesn't throw as hard, but he still has a way with the Blue Jays and still has a way in this ballpark. So it's not an easy matchup at all for the Blue Jays as they move into the third of four games. The one thing that may be in the Blue Jays' favor is that Mike Soch has indicated that he does want to give Albert Pujols and Mike Trout a day off at some point during the series, a day off the turf, whether that means as a DH or whatever. He wants to give them a day off the turf. So maybe that will come into play. But if I know Mike Soch, my guess is that he might be thinking, let's try to at least get a split of the series with a win tonight, and then we can make our move tomorrow and rest one of these guys. Or he may decide to rest one day and one the other day. But anyhow, that may in fact play into the hands of Drew Hutchison. You heard in the first hour I made mention of James Hinchcliffe, and I made the point. He's been in the show a couple of times. You know, he's almost part of the furniture on Bob McCowan's show. We show the Indy races, so he's known to just about everybody around here in this newsroom and certainly in the TV studio. He's around quite often. And, you know, of course, that he had a horrific horrific accident on Monday. Essentially, the broken wishbone part of his car punctured his left leg, I believe the femoral artery, although details have not been released. He lost a significant amount of blood, but he is listed in stable condition, largely as a result of the tremendous work by the safety crew on site, the Holmatra safety crew that was on site. Scott Goodyear is ESPN's IndyCar analyst. He's certainly no stranger to the track. He's certainly no stranger to the dangers of racing. Scott Goodyear joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Hey, Scott, thanks a lot for doing this. Obviously, largely good news, real good news on James Hinchcliffe. But talk to me a bit about this Holmatra safety team that James Hinchcliffe, you know, has made very clear that he's crediting these guys with, you know, making the best of a really bad situation.
Jeff, good morning. Yes, they are absolutely the best. And one thing that IndyCar does that other racing series do not, including NASCAR, is they have a dedicated crew that not only works here at Indianapolis, but also goes on the road. No matter where the event is, not only in North America, they come to the Toronto Indy, and also they were with me when I crashed in Brazil when I was driving, and I broke my back. And, you know, the guys from America were there. They helped, assisted. They know the drivers. They know the families. And, you know, they've got a file on you, so they know exactly. For instance, I broke my back a second time in my career, so when they got to the car, they were very cautious, knowing that, you know, this guy might have the same type of injury. So absolutely, certainly saved James' life the other day.
Now, are we talking about, are they all doctors, or are they a combination of doctors and you know, physiotherapists and firemen, I mean, whatever. You know, they're basically first responders for IndyCar. What background do they have?
They are first responders in many different functions. There's four different vehicles that arrive at the scene. And just to give you a quick indication of that, one safety one actually has a computer on board, and it's getting real-time telemetry from all the cars, not only from the impact from the black box for the car itself, much like an aircraft, but also they have ear accelerometers in the driver's earpieces, so attached to their ears. They can also see the G-loading that the driver sustained when he crashed. So when a multi-car crash, for instance, happens, like we've had previously, they'll be able to see with the first car with the highest G loading, and they know to respond to that car first, second, third, or what have you. In Jane's situation, the responders that get there, and it's the same at every event that we go to, we have fire and rescue that are at the top of their field in multiple trucks. We actually have the firemen there that are obviously there to put out flames if that's the problem. We have first-level doctors. We have trauma doctors. And we also have surgeons on site traveling to each and every event that we go to. So, for instance, Dr. Terry Trammell, who was the chap that worked on my back twice, was the first responder when I crashed in Brazil back in the 90s in a cart car. And it gives you great feeling that you know that they are there to help and assist.
In conversation with Scott Goodyear on the Jeff Blair Show, it's too early to talk about this, but we know that James is not going to be racing in the immediate future. Scott, how difficult is it going to be for him to get back into a car after a serious injury like this? And using your own experience as a backdrop, because at some point. At some point you're back in and you're going real fast and you're kind of back in the situation you were in before.
Well, you are, but you know, when you are younger, and I'm going to say this in two phases here. When I've had multiple crashes and I'm one of the guys walking around with steel and screws in myself. But when my first crash happened around James' age, you are so anxious to get back into it. Once you feel like you're able to do it, then you want to go do it. The next time I was in my late 30s and the doctors were telling me what I needed to do, and you're going, you tell me whatever needs to happen, I'll take whatever you tell me and I'll be in no hurry. James will be in a hurry because of his young age to get back in the car. He has probably another decade of driving ahead of him. Loves motor racing, as you guys know, born and raised in Toronto, and has done such a great job no matter where he's raced in the world. It will be mentally tough. At first, you have to get through the physical part. As you're laying in the hospital bed, as I have, probably in the same hospital that he is down here in Indianapolis, it plays on you mentally, but it plays on you mentally differently because you want to get up and get going. You feel like you're leaving something on the table, and you do question whether or not you'll be back to the same level that you were previous to the accident, but most young drivers do return to the same level.
Now, this, Scott, this was, I think, the fifth crash in the week, maybe the fourth, fifth crash in the week. And we know that IndyCar, that they met with Honda and Chevrolet, to determine whether, I guess, the aerodynamic kits that they'd installed in the cars were causing problems. I believe, and again, this is just sort of my knowledge from watching TV and that the horsepower in these cars was actually eliminated a little bit, or was actually less than what we've seen earlier in the year, yet you still had an accident. Is there something wrong aerodynamically with the cars, and is this something that that needs to be addressed before too many more accidents happen?
Probably really yes to all those questions, and when I say that, what they do here in qualifying at Indianapolis is give the engines more boost because they're turbocharged engines. The guys get about 50 more horsepower. Cars go 6 or 7 miles an hour faster. We started to run into problems not because of the increased boost or horsepower, but because of the new aerodynamic kits this year. The crashes that were caused were not caused by the aerodynamic kits that they put on,
Okay. But
the result of the cars then hitting the wall and going backwards, the cars started to get into the air, which I'm sure you've seen the video for, and that is the result of the new aerodynamic pieces. Elio Castroneves had a setup problem, Joseph Newgarden had a tire going down, and so they weren't causing, the crashes were not caused by the aero kits, the end result of the cars getting in the air were. In James's situation, his car had a suspension piece failure, which they call the rocker arm, which is a suspension piece on the right front corner. And I tell you, Jeff, it could not have happened at the worst spot than it did. He was already going down to the center of the turn, which we call the apex. He was doing probably 227 miles an hour, and by the time the car got to impacted the wall, they're estimating it was at 220 miles an hour. Now, we just gave praise to the safety crew. We also have to give praise to the car manufacturer, what IndyCar has done, and Indianapolis Motor Speedway has done to make things safer. IndyCar with the chassis and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for designing over a decade ago what they call the safer barrier, and it's a steel and foam energy-absorbing item that goes in front of the concrete wall. It's now been applied to all NASCAR tracks. NASCAR adopted it. And it was terrific because the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Holman George family over 10, 12 years ago paid for this invention, and it's now saving drivers' lives.
Scott, listen, it was great to talk to you again, you know, to the NASCAR family and to all the people who know and deal with James on a daily basis, and certainly his friends and family. We extend our best wishes. And like I said, I know a lot of us who were watching that probably, they thought about, well, we thought about the other Canadian drivers we've had and a couple of Canadian drivers we've lost. And it's really great to talk to you. And again, the conversation's been very enlightening. And thank you so much for doing this.
Well, I appreciate it. James is healing. He'll be back in the car, I'm sure, next year. And he, like everybody else, will be watching us on ABC on Sunday afternoon for 99th running in the Indy 500. And we'll see you guys in Toronto.
Sounds good, Scott. Take care.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Scott Goodyear, IndyCar analyst and ESPN. Got breaking news. Let's go to the Sportsnet 590, the fan newsroom. Andrew Nye.
Jeff.
Yes. You got a hamburger for me?
I was going to ask you if you like hamburgers.
I do.
Do you like the Hamburglar?
No.
Too bad.
He scares me.
Well,
clowns scare me, too.
He lives on in Ottawa. The Senators have agreed to terms with goaltender Andrew Hammond on a 3-year extension. It works out to $1.35 million a season. It also means one of Robin Leonard or Craig Anderson won't be returning. The Sharks, Oilers, Blues, Sabres, all looking for goaltenders. I hear the Sabres need a coach, too, Jeff.
Thanks. Andrew Nye on our Sportsnet 590 The Fan News. So there you go. Everybody, load up on your burgers and toss them on the ice. The Hamburglar returneth. Seriously, yeah, the Hamburglar is the scariest. Travis, because I know you're a big guy with mascots and you've been to Disney more times than most 14-year-olds. I got to ask you this, Travis. Of all the McDonald's characters, who's the freakiest? Which one scares you the most? Which one scares you the most, Travis? Why does Ronald McDonald scare you? Well, clowns are in general are creepy, and he is that. But doesn't the Hamburglar sort of suggest, isn't there more of an implied threat with the Hamburglar? Like Grimace? Yeah, Grimace has got some issues, Lance. We'll talk about that off air. There's a lot of rumors about Grimace, some of the stuff he likes to do. Anyhow, that's, again, we appreciate Scott Goodyear joining us. And not to make light of the situation, we really, really, really hope that James Hinchcliffe gets better soon. And we look forward to seeing him next year, and again to his friends and family. Just thank God that safety team was in place. And Scott Goodyear giving us an indication of just how important that safety team is. You know what? I've thought about this since I first mentioned it. I'm really serious. You should be able to score a goal in the NHL by heading the puck into the net. Andrew Shaw should have been given a goal for heading the puck into the net last night. Mark Osborne is our Stanley Cup playoffs pregame and intermission host on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Mark Osborne will join the Jeff Blair Show. We're going to talk about headers in hockey. I think they should be allowed. I think it's a dumb rule. We'll see what Mark Osborne says. He'll join us on the Jeff Blair Show right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
So you know what? Barker is going to take his turn answering phone calls today on Baseball Central. We got to call in at 416-870-0590, star 590, 1-888-666-0590. And talk to Kevin and myself about the Jays situation. We really haven't, we had the interview with Alex Anthopoulos yesterday, and we really haven't had a chance to talk in detail to you fans out there. So we'll get you to call in this afternoon. We'll get you to call in on Baseball Central. And we'll take your calls, and you can talk to Barker about stuff as well as me. I think we have to do that a little more often. We will have baseball for you tonight. Jared Weaver on the mound for the Angels. He's always tough in the Blue Jays. Drew Hutchison on the mound for the aforementioned Blue Jays. Blue Jays Central live at 6:30 p.m. on Sportsnet Ontario with Jamie Campbell and Greg Zahn. First pitch from the Rogers Center shortly after 7 on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, Jerry Howarth, Joe Siddle, Mike Wilner, the call of the game. Buck Martinez, Pat Tabler, Barry Davis. We'll have the game for you in Sportsnet Ontario. And then afterwards, Mike Wilner will take your calls on the Blue Jays talk on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Listen to Wilner last night, and they had an interesting discussion. And Barker and I are gonna kind of riff on this. Mike had an interesting discussion with a caller about sort of this whole notion about the Blue Jays offense being quote-unquote inconsistent, which is something I've always kind of had a problem with. And the caller was making the point that, well, the Blue Jays, it's feast or famine. They either win by 10 or they lose by, or, you know, or they either score 10 runs or they score 3 or less and da-da-da. And then if you look around Major League Baseball, you find out, you know what? If you pick the best teams in baseball, they're scoring 3 runs or less in games at roughly the same clip as the Blue Jays are. The difference is they're getting some decent starting pitching. So it was an interesting discussion about the whole nature of consistent or inconsistent offense, and Barker and I will talk about it. Because I find that one of the things I like about baseball is that sort of the general narratives you get in other sports, momentum, consistent offense, things of that nature, just don't fly in baseball. And, you know, John Lowe, my good friend, he covered the Tigers for years for the Detroit Free Press, once pointed out to me that the reason it's different is because baseball is the only sport, I guess you could use cricket as well, they're the only sports where the defense has possession of the ball. I mean, the first act of a baseball game is me as the pitcher trying to prevent you as the offensive player from doing everything. Every other sport, the first act of the game is generally me trying to score on you, not me trying to prevent you from scoring or me trying to limit what you can do. So I think there's a lot to it, and I think that's one of the reasons that you can't take the general principles from other sports and just kind of throw them out there and extrapolate them and talk about momentum and things of that nature. You know, it's why I always kind of laugh when people say, fire the hitting coach. They need a new hitting coach. Well, it's not the offensive coordinator. Get a new pitching coach in. He's not the defensive coordinator. You know, people were talking about Pete Walker yesterday. And my argument is, you know what? You can bring Jesus in as your pitching coach. R.A. Dickey still ain't going to throw a knuckleball. I mean, seriously, this idea that somehow changing coaches will instantly make players better. You know, someone said, well, it'll light a fire under their ass. They need more pitchers to have a fire under their ass like Aaron Sanchez. You really think Mark Burley needs a fire under his ass after 1,000 years? You think he's going to do? He's going to throw 84 instead of 83? Think R.A. Dickey needs a fire under his ass to throw a little harder knuckleball? So we'll talk about this whole notion of consistent and inconsistent offense. I mean, I think more than anything else, baseball is a game of efficiency. If you're trying to find a word to describe how you win baseball games, I think you try to be efficient. You try to distribute your weapons, your skills, in a manner that allows you to stay in the game the longest. We'll talk about that with Barker. The Rangers and Lightning will play the third game of their series tonight. In Tampa, that game is at 8 o'clock. It'll be, of course, on CBC, on sportsnet.ca/590, and, as always, on Rogers NHL Game Center Live. Eastern Conference Finals are tied up at 1-1. Chicago and Anaheim, that game looked like it would never end. Well, it did end. And as it usually does, in triple overtime with the Blackhawks won the game. Mark Osborne is our Stanley Cup playoffs pregame and intermission host on Sportsnet 590. You can follow him on Twitter at MarkOsborne21. Mark Osborne joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. I got to ask you about that headed goal last night. You know, Mark, my first reaction is I thought it did count. I thought it would count. And then, of course, you know, immediately you find out the rule book. I mean, it's pretty clear. There's no debate about it. But should you be allowed to head the puck in the net?
You know what? that's a great question, and I think we are doing the same thing. Is this a goal? We've never seen anything like that in the history since I've been watching hockey as a kid, and certainly back in the 60s, they wouldn't be trying to do that without a helmet on. But give Andrew Shaw a lot of credit for trying to be creative. And, yeah, I mean, we thought about it and then decided, well, certainly, you go into the part of kicking the puck in with your skate, and that could, potentially provide injury in some respect down on the ice. So you want to be cautious about that. And I would have to probably say the same thing if a guy was on his knees and he's going to be lunging his head towards the puck. I don't think that for safety reason, would necessarily be the best thing to try to do. But I got to give Andrew Shaw a lot of credit. I mean, there's a lot of people that really didn't realize what the rule was. But, in fact, Lord Stellick, who has his rule book always handy, 78-4, he said, you can't head the puck in as a.k.a. like you would with the Toronto FC.
Mark, you played a ton of hockey. What would Bruce Boudreau say to his team today or the next time when they gather for a practice or a workout or whatever ahead of the next game? What do you say to your team after you've lost a game in triple overtime where you've hit crossbars and goal posts and, in addition to hitting the goalie?
Well, you would probably say, I don't think your message is going to change even before you headed into this series, because I think we knew that it's going to be a long series. Anytime you play a team that has been resilient, as experienced as the Chicago Blackhawks have been for so many years, it's disheartening, I think, to get that far into a hockey game and obviously be the team that comes out on the losing end of things. It certainly is a game of momentum, and one of the arts of coaching, you would agree, Jeff, is to keep your players as hopeful and as optimistic as possible. I mean, who can imagine what it really does feel like? I've never been to a triple overtime myself. The farthest I'd been was in double overtime, and that was sitting on the bench watching Doug Gilmour do his infamous behind-the-net backhand play on Curtis Joseph. And so, it's certainly when you put everything out onto the table and play as long as those guys did last night, I'm sure Bruce Boudreau's troops are, it's demoralizing, but at the end of the day, you wake up and you realize this is what playoff hockey is all about. It's a real fine line between winning and losing, and right now it would appear, going back to the United Center, that's a huge momentum gainer for the Blackhawks, because this Anaheim Duck team is a very challenging and a difficult team to play against with their depth, and this is going to be a wonderful series as unfolded in these first two games.
Mark, as a guy who played this game, when you watch the Blackhawks play, we're used to the Blackhawks have had a lot of success. They won a couple of Stanley Cups. Jonathan Toews, great leader, yada, yada. As fans, there's all sorts of stuff that we see with the Blackhawks. What do you see as a former player that separates the Blackhawks from other teams? When you watch that game, what do you see that says, boy, this team is a little more special?
Yeah, well, there's, first and foremost, is their leadership core. I mean, Jonathan Toews, I don't think there's anyone in today's game that is as passionate about winning. I think the Blackhawks, they hate to lose. And when you think about having won just one Stanley Cup, that a lot of organizations get certainly satisfied with being able to get to that, the ultimate goal of what every boy, growing up in Canada wants to be able to hoist that Stanley Cup. But it just seems like two cups is not enough. Each and every year, these guys are determined. I think they just simply hate to lose. And one of the things I think we would have gleaned out of watching the road to the Winter Classic is how classy of an organization the Chicago Blackhawks are, but how much they just love winning. And it's such a prideful thing, but that's part of their DNA. And then as you watch the likes of a Duncan Keith, a Seabrook, you go up and down the list of their, their players in particular, I'm so impressed the way that they're so poised, the way that they manage the puck, the way that they compete. I mean, this is 1 through 20. This is not just all about the top dogs. They can instill guys like the guy who scored the overtime winner last night, Kruger, gets a game winner, and it's really seamless, much like the Detroit Red Wings and how they've been able to year after year after year. If it's if it's not Datsyuk and Zetterberg, then it becomes the new generation of Tatar and a Nyquist, and that seems to be exactly what's gone on with the Blackhawks for these last many, many years. I mean, what a class organization.
We've got about a minute and a half left here. What is Alain Vigneault? Is there anything Marc Alain Vigneault can do to get Rick Nash and Martin St. Louis going in the series?
Oh, you know what? Maybe take 10 years off of Marty St. Louis, and that's something he can't do. Rick Nash is he's a real perplexing person, and no question about it, Jeff. The fact is, I don't know how you can be 6'4", and if you watch Rick Nash over the years during the regular season, how he has the ability to skate, to drive the puck in today's game, why he's not willing to do that at this time of year. I mean, we all know that the game does change when it comes to the postseason, but it certainly has been disappointing to really try to figure out as to why he doesn't want to do that on a more consistent basis. We saw glimpses of it in game one, but game two, again, too much on the perimeter. And, if you were able to give a recipe of success to Alain Vigneault, I'm sure he'd take any suggestions to get his 42-goal score going. I mean, you can't get to the dance again this year unless Rick Nash has to contribute in some fashion.
Mark, it was great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Okay, Jeff. Take care.
Mark Osborne. He is the pregame and intermission host on our Sportsnet 590, the fan coverage of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Game 3 of the Eastern Conference Final tonight, Rangers-Lightning. It's tied 1-1, 8 p.m. on CBC, sportsnet.ca/590, and, of course, as always, on Rogers NHL Game Center Live. We'll talk about that game tomorrow when the Jeff Blair Show returns, but right now we got to shift focus a little bit, put on our baseball caps. Kevin Barker's going to join me. Baseball Central will hit the airwaves. We'll take your calls about the Blue Jays and Angels. Anything you want to talk about baseball-related, we're your guys. Talk to you in a couple of minutes.